Today, cutting through the bull. Ali Guinness, Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Friday afternoon, Tarek Brooker's with me. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
I'm very good. Welcome back from your sojourn down in Melbourne.
Thanks, mate. It was a great experience. I actually met a viewer of DFA there in person. It was a big shout out to Mark. Thanks for coming to say hello. And thanks for making the first experience with a viewer so fantastic and such a rewarding one.
All right, so you found my viewer. Well done. Yeah, well, a shout out to Mark too. Now, we're going to spend a little bit of time today talking about our favourite subject, right? We put up a post yesterday because we knew you were going to be a bit tight for time. And interestingly, pretty much everybody on Twitter said, what we really like you to talk about is this whole question of inflation and what's really going on. And guess what? That's quite relevant, right? Because overnight we had the US inflation number, which was superficially lower, but we've got some questions about that. But there's also some quite important questions that probably we should get to in terms of the way that the numbers are developed, what's driving them, and, well, frankly, how meaningful are they? So, you know, lots of things we can talk about.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure where to start. Do you want to start with the list of questions from the viewers, or do you want to sort of start out with a little bit of flavor in terms of, you know, last night's inflation report, and we can work from there, whichever you prefer.
Why don't we go with the inflation report first, because I think it actually would set the conversation up quite well. But, you know, essentially the sorts of questions that came out from Twitter was comparatively looking at inflation here versus in the US, right? How inflation actually translates to monetary policy. And interestingly, and by the way, this was discussed in the Senate FRBA discussion yesterday, to what extent does lifting interest rates actually lift inflation? Which, if you think about it, is actually an interesting question as well. So why don't we get going? And of course, you couldn't go past this particular chart, right, to start with.
Yeah, I couldn't. All the various commentary today on the inflation report, I wasn't going to do slides. I wasn't sure I had time, but then I got annoyed and motivated, and I ended up putting this little ditty together. As usual, if you want to have a look at the charts, they'll be available at avidcom.substack.com. A big thank you to everyone who's donated, supported, joined my Patreon. It's all very much appreciated. And without further ado, we'll get right into it. Yesterday, inflation came in quite a lot lower, coming in at 7.7% year on year. And it's just worth noting that that is below the 7.9% that was expected. Yet, it's quite a bit more complicated than that, and we're going to get to that in just a few slides' time. If you've got any comments, Martin, go for it.
Just one thing I will say, Tarek, it's worth just highlighting the services component, which is the blue, ex food and energy, right? It's still going up. Now, that's a really, really important thing to hang on to as we go through our conversation, right? Because whilst we might see that some of the goods is coming down a little, services, which of course includes cost of people as well as actually other things, is still going up. So just mark your card on that one.
Yeah, 100%. And that's a point that Wolf Richter made from Wolf Street. Great, great resource. I'll put a link in my Substack post. But he was saying that if not for the distortions created by the healthcare deflation, believe it or not, but we'll get to that in detail in just a moment. Yep. If not for that, it would have been the highest services inflation print ever. Yep. And forever is a long time.
Yeah, exactly right. And the point about that is that service inflation is the type that's sticky and embedded, and it's still going up. So whatever else you might think about costs of petrol coming down and all those things, right, we still have a problem. And, you know, the service inflation alone is above the Fed's target. So
it's almost twice the Fed's target. That's what's so crazy.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, this is where the distortion starts. How do I explain this without it sounding stupid? Because it is stupid. Anyway, there is a component in the US healthcare CPI, which is basically how health insurance changes in terms of the the overall month on month change. Now, you would just think that they would go, okay, how much is person A paying for health insurance? How much is person B paying for health insurance? How much has it risen? Ergo, the health insurance component rises by X amount. Now, that's how personal consumption expenditure, which is the Fed's inflation measure, functions. But the CPI functions a bit differently. It's based on the profitability and retained earnings of health insurers. And because of this distortion, we've seen this enormous deflation in the CPI for month on month for health insurance, which, as any American will tell you, their health insurance costs aren't coming down by 4% in a month. I'll tell you what.
Yeah. Well, actually, compared with last month, it was up 2-point-something%, now down 4%. So there was a 6% move month over month in this one.
It's really something to watch because, I did a bit of math before. I think we actually had a bit of a brief exchange on Twitter about, if not for this distortion and if healthcare inflation remained as the same as it was last month in terms of month-on-month figures, we would have seen a 0.44% core CPI print, which is near as makes no difference, close enough to 5 for there not really to be a huge, huge market reaction. But instead, you get this huge distortion and you've got the NASDAQ up 7%. You've got the biggest stock rally since April 2020.
Yeah. And just one other point about this adjustment. It's going to stay in the numbers now for the next 11 forward periods, right? Because they do it annually. They actually make this adjustment once every 12 months. So, crazy.
Magic. Now, this contributed to the lowest contribution to the medical care element of the CPI since 1972, 50 years ago. It's that big of a distortion that has thrown things absolutely for six. So, I think that all this celebration that inflation is over, that everything's done and everything's finished, I think that's more than a little bit premature.
I think more than a bit premature. It is completely misreading what the data is actually saying, right? Because you go the superficial and then everybody's, well, whoopee, that means that they'll be able to actually take the rate up just slightly more rather than significantly more. And it's interesting, of course, we're not talking pivots here. We're talking about the rate of increase in the Fed rate just moving up a little more slowly, and yet the markets said, oh great, well, it's all going to turn around, we're going to see inflation conquered, etc. But they just haven't understood what's driving it. And it's also worth just looking, within the components, you've got other elements too. The rental stuff's still bubbling around there, and there's some really peculiar anomalies between real rents and how rents are actually reported still. And there's some other things too. And of course, it's worth underscoring the healthcare element that we touched on feeds directly into the services part of that CPI that we looked at.
Yeah, so how exactly? And how much worse it would look, even if it were neutral, let alone if it was showing the acceleration that's actually happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. So fascinating, fascinating, fascinating.
Oh, 100%. Now, I think it's also worth noting that and this is something that we actually talked about now in our last show, that a large part of the drop that we saw in the CPI was actually driven, the deceleration in the growth of the CPI was actually because of falling used car prices. Now, this is something that I've looked at extensively because I believe it's going to be a fairly major factor. If you see a full mean reversion in inflation-adjusted terms of used car prices over the next, say, 12 months, you're going to see them lop off about 1.3% of core CPI, which is a fairly significant portion, particularly as the other goods inputs slow as well. So I think this is really something that's worth keeping in mind going forward, particularly given that this is a limited time only factor. It's going to flatter inflation to the downside over the next 12 to 18 months, depending on how long it takes to play out. But once that passes, and that deflationary factor is removed on a month-on-month basis and then finally on a year-on-year basis, all of a sudden inflation is going to look like it's going to start to accelerate again. So, I think that's something that's really worth keeping an eye on when, central bankers and when fiscal policymakers make the decisions when we inevitably have the slowdown, that this is a factor that's pinning inflation down rather than, you know, making it rise as it did in 2021.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, because there are a series of volatile movements, but underlying them, there is still this structural element to inflation, all right? And anybody who argues that this is transitory now, you know, well, forget it. It's not. It's stuck. It's sticky. It's lodged in position. And there was a report that came out also yesterday that said that in real terms, income is still going backwards, right? So despite the fact that people are actually earning a little more, inflation's still a lot stronger, which means they're still actually going backwards in real terms. So there's still huge deflationary pressures now on household patterns of spending. And meanwhile, of course, all of those stimulus that was around earlier on is being removed, and, you know, people are therefore up against it. Credit is rising. People are using more credit than previously to try and get by. So you've got to say that whilst it might look superficially as though, you know, we've turned the corner, when you actually start peeling back the onion, there are some really significant factors still in the mix here.
It is. And I mean, even if you sort of take one of some of the more bullish sort of scenarios where, you know, we get back to sort of 3.5% core inflation at the end of, towards the end of next year, and you see an associated decline in, you know, in wages growth as well. I mean, you're still talking about households going backwards, spending power going backwards. And that's particularly true here in Australia, where wages are growing a lot slower than they are in the US. I mean, here they haven't even, you know, they haven't even cracked 3% yet, you know, and inflation has been while heading up towards 8 or so, depending on, you know, which estimate you go with. So, you know, I think that damage that it's doing to the economy is really, really understated. It's really overlooked, because it's not really something that a lot of people have experience with.
Yeah.
You know, we're used to these, you know, random inflation shocks. You know, we had them in the 80s, you know, and, you know, you'd have a year where there'd be inflation higher than wages, and then the next year wages would rocket higher than inflation, and everything would sort of balance itself out. But we don't live in that sort of world anymore where you're going to see, you know, 6% wages and 3% inflation. That's not going to happen. The RBA will stomp on the economy before that happens. So I think it's really just important to sort of keep that in perspective, that, you know, we are essentially losing, you know, over a decade worth of real household income growth. And this, to me, is why I think Bill Evans at Westpac, who made this point, that basically the RBA is taking enormous risk by not pursuing rate cuts sufficiently aggressively. Because if they make a mistake, and if they're wrong again, and they might be, and inflation is already entrenched, they've wasted this time when we could have attacked it more aggressively when the labor market was still strong. And instead, we end up with more real wage, more falling real wages, and then they're confronted with a really challenging situation. Do they raise rates in a prolonged downturn or even a recession? What do they do? Or do they just let inflation just, you know, off the hook? And, you know, I think Bill Evans made quite a good point in that, in his little note for Westpac. I think it was last week.
No, I agree, Tarek. And it's interesting because Michelle Bullock was actually interrogated quite nicely by the Senate yesterday. It's actually, if you've got a couple of hours to do, you know, spend, it's worth watching the replay, because there were some really important points. But one of the things that they were arguing about a little bit was how important is it for, you know, inflation to get under control, right? And she was very much arguing again, inflation is the scourge. It's the real big scourge. We've got to get it under control, right? And then there was a discussion about real wages versus nominal wages. Interestingly, the RBA tends to, when it says wages, it's assuming nominal wages rather than real wages, which is interesting. I hadn't actually appreciated that, but they argue that, well, if we were to use real wages, then we'd actually have an inflationary feedback loop in our numbers. So nominal wages rather than real wages, right? But there was a very... you couldn't make this stuff up, right? You couldn't make this stuff up. But what was quite interesting was that the discussion got to the point where there was a little bit of an exploration as to whether, in fact, higher interest rates was actually creating inflation rather than actually squashing inflation, right? And I think it was Nick McKim asking about, well, hang on a moment, if you put inflation rates up, people need more wages to be able to actually cover the additional costs that are being generated. Isn't that actually creating more inflation? And it was very interesting trying to watch the RBA wriggle out of that quite interesting discussion.
It's a challenging question, though, isn't it? If you think about it, you know, at a fundamental level, because on as you say, if costs are going up, then the desire to get a wage rise, you know, also conversely goes up. And then there's also the balance between additional income for savers versus less spending power for borrowers. I mean, I think really it's just about what it comes down to is the balance in the end. You know, I mean, yes, that, you know, say for example, there is in net terms, obviously the banks are bringing in more cash than they're sending out to savers because, well, they're the banks. So that's what they do for a living.
Yes.
But it's also the fact that, you know, that generally the people with these biggest savings balances tend to be older. They tend to take that money and invest it or reinvest it into some other sort of financial product or whatever, rather than, you know, younger people who do have mortgages, who are more likely to, if they have a windfall in terms of the cash flow, well, they're more likely to spend it. So that's more likely to be inflationary. So, I mean, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on it, on the question.
No, I think it's very, and it is complex, right? Because there are different segments of the community with different footprints, right? So you've got the debt-laden, particularly younger households who've got a big mortgage, and every time the rates go up, that puts more pressure on their budgets, which means they have to spend less or they have to reprioritize. And we're certainly seeing that at the moment. In fact, the latest data that I've seen shows that some of those households are really having to cut back now, and we're seeing that in spades. But then you've got those with at a different stage in their journey, perhaps, with, as you say, more assets behind them, more savings in the bank or wherever. And in fact, as rates go up, they've got more capacity to do things. And interestingly, that some, and again, in my surveys, some of these households who went through a very, very torrid time over the last 3 or 4 years, when rates came down and down and down and down and down, returns on term deposits went close to zero. They actually didn't have much wriggle room, but now they've got more wriggle room because guess what? They've now got more money coming back in as the rates go up. And suddenly they've got more capacity to spend, and they are actually spending. So you've actually got this really interesting tussle between, you know, the debt side of the house and the credit, the investment side of the house. And then you've got this other question, which of course is, well, you know, if you look at those people with superannuation, a lot of people are telling me that their superannuation balances have dropped dramatically over the last few months, right? And that's a bit of a shock because most people have tended to see superannuation returns being relatively positive. So some of those people who are actually saving towards retirement, so the people in the middle, are actually now in the situation where suddenly their retirement situation is looking more precarious than it was. So you've got all these different countervailing forces. And the other interesting factor just on that is if you talk to young people who are trying to save for a deposit, well, now they're actually getting a bit more interest on the deposit that they can actually get if they save a bit. But on the other hand, their ability to borrow because of the borrowing power, because rates have gone up, has dropped. So in fact, housing affordability is pivoted now. So it's not just the deposit problem. It's actually now the ability to get the loan problem. So you can see how complicated this all is. It's a really complicated jigsaw puzzle. So in a way, I understand why these debates can be quite complicated. But, you know, it just shows you that this simplistic headline stuff doesn't really get you very far at all.
No, and I think it's worth noting that the issues that you're describing in terms of, you know, borrowing power, et cetera, is these are the problems that we're seeing with a cash rate of less than 3%. You know, we are still a long, long, long way away from, you know, historic levels of rates, of the cash rate and mortgage rates for that matter. So I think that it's a rather sort of interesting set of circumstances in that regard because, you know, where is the long-term cash rate going to be? I mean, even, you know, Governor Lowe himself reckons it's about 2.5% to 3.5%. So we haven't even reached the middle of that particular little butter zone yet.
No, I think that's a really important point. And, you know, interestingly, because you can get term deposits now for 5 years at 4.95%, right? Which is actually, yeah, you know, over the medium to long term, that's not a bad term deposit rate. So folks, it might be interesting to, if you've got money floating around with nothing to do, that's not a bad rate. My expectation is that rates won't go up that much higher from where they are, a little bit, but then they'll actually sort of go sideways. But over the next couple of years, they are going to probably come down a little bit because I think that's probably above where that neutral rate is. But this idea of what the neutral rate is really quite flawed, it seems to me, because you actually, it's not one neutral rate for the economy, right? The neutral rate is probably different for different types of households in different circumstances and maybe even different states.
It is. I mean, they've people have made that point, you know, numerous times that different states, different cities need different interest rates. Because, you know, say, for example, Perth during the mining boom needed a higher rate to contain its inflationary pressures, you know, compared with, say, for example, you know, Melbourne, which was, you know, struggling more because of its status as a manufacturing centre in relative terms, at least at the time.
Well, I think what we should do, we should create the Illawarra Yuan.
You call it that, mate. You might get some state backing with right like that.
Exactly right, because it seems to me that the local economic conditions down here where I am, you know, are extremely different from other parts of the country, right? And this is part of the problem, particularly I think because we've got such a very large continent, and we've got very significant mixes of, you know, circumstances with regional versus city and different types of households and things. So it shows you that there is a complexity. And I suppose it also makes the point that you always end up trying to average the average, right? To try and work out, do I pull the lever hard and how hard do I pull it? Which is what the RBA is trying to do. But it does show you that there's a whole bunch of questions here below, you know, below the waterline. Then the second question, of course, is, well, but are the measurements actually the measurements? Are they giving you the true story anyway? Because if I look at the data from my surveys, a lot of people are saying that their costs have gone up significantly more than the CPI is telling them, right? Now, of course, that's partly because of the mix of different things. So vegetables are much more expensive than they were, tend to be quite volatile, and other factors too. So even the official numbers, well, they're a bit questionable at the best of times.
I think that's an interesting question, because even if you sort of strip out all the other issues with the CPI in terms of data collection and everything else, and that's something that a lot of people have covered over the years. You know, you've covered it, Edwin's covered it, Louis from SQM has covered it in particular in terms of the rental component. But if you're just talking about what people actually spend their money on, that's where I think you see this really interesting divergence. Say, like in the US, PCE, personal consumption expenditure, is much, much closer to the actual expenditure of households on various different items. So the weightings are wildly, wildly different to what they are in the CPI. So I think that's a good example, at least, I mean, obviously it's not perfect because it's not Australia, but I think that's a good example of how different the consumption of real households is to what the CPI says it, not so much says it is, but sort of implies it is.
Well, of course, the CPI is by definition an average, and whilst it's broken out by state and by different categories and things, real households, you know, have very significant mixes. And if you look at the inflation rate, for example, for amongst older households and the way that they spend their money, they probably won't have the same costs of accommodation because quite often they'll own their property outright, whereas many younger households will have significant mortgage pressure or indeed rental pressure. And we have a sort of rental proxy that doesn't really do the job, in my view, in any case. And you've got this other thing. If you're actually out in the outer suburban areas where you're totally reliant on driving around because the infrastructure doesn't actually really help you to get around, transportation costs can be a lot more expensive. And then if you look at things like childcare costs and even school fees, well, they vary geographically. So, you know, all of those things, you know, really create huge variations. And if you have other things like, well, you know, individuals' health care costs will vary depending on whether they are healthy or whether they're not, and whether they've got long-term medical issues or whether they haven't. So the average masks the differences. And I sometimes get very frustrated with the ABS because, you know, their high-level stuff really doesn't really give you a lot of granularity as to how varying it is. And of course it comes back to this point, you've got the average of the average, and then you try and set a policy to manage the average of the average, but it actually doesn't fit anybody really.
I think that's interesting. I think that's an interesting point. I mean, like, even if you look at the averages that we do have, you know, the breakdowns that we do have, like, you look at inflation, say, in WA, inflation in WA is basically, you know, within the same ballpark as the US now already. I think that's a real sort of, you know, rams home the point of how challenging inflation is in Australia, and B, just how varying it can be. You know, I mean, realistically, if you look at inflation in WA, you know, and if we go back to what we were talking about previously in terms of having different rates for different states,
yep.
Perth should have you know, rates that are probably 1% higher than what they are now, if they want to contain that level of inflation. Particularly because the WA economy is, you know, significantly stronger than those in the eastern states.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, it just begs the question, doesn't it? At what level should you be making some of these calls? And, of course, we have, you know, $1 for the whole of Australia, but for very different circumstances. The other interesting question here is, of course, the calculation of inflation has actually morphed over time. And if you go back over the past 25 to 30 years, now the RBA has been responsible for directing quite a few of the changes, as well as the ABS itself. And, you know, there are people who've tried to go back and work out what inflation would have been reported at if they'd have used the old method rather than the new method. And I've seen a few of those, and there are a few different numbers. But certainly the inflation would actually be a lot higher on the old basis compared with now. And then you can ask the question, well, is that because it's convenient to report it in that particular way? Because if inflation's lower, does that have consequences? Or is it simply that... Well, the numbers are wrong, whatever, however you calculate them.
Well, that's an interesting question, because like recently the National Bureau of Economic Research in the US, which is basically the sort of peak body for looking into the economy, and they're also the people who definitively call US recessions rather than the sort of two quarters of negative growth definition that we all share in most of the rest of the world. They did a paper on comparing inflation now with comparing inflation in the 70s, if the 1970s and the 1960s and everything and all these other prior eras use the same methodology as what is used today. And it came to a startling discovery. Well, startling, depending on your perspective, I suppose. But inflation at its peak in 2022 was higher than inflation at its peak in 1974 in the middle of the original oil crisis. And I think that just really rams home how strong inflationary pressures actually are. And just before I go off on a 15-minute rant about the stupidity of some takes on inflation, ultimately the target is 2%. And unless we're sort of seeing these huge, big strides towards that, nothing really is going to fundamentally change on a sort of longer-term perspective. Okay, the Fed might not raise by as much in a single meeting, and they'll spread it out over a couple more instead. But I don't really see it sort of fundamentally changing all that much, even though the market thinks it's, you know, it's a completely different kettle of fish.
Yeah, well, the market's just jumping from one thing to the other. You know, if you look at the volatility and the number of times that there have been significant movements day on day on day, I think we've had a record this year, right? It just shows you how uncertain things are. But just in terms of calculating, if you calculate the inflation on the old basis, go back to the version in the early 70s. I mean, I've done it only at back of an envelope level, but I reckon that real inflation on that basis will be somewhere between 15 and 17%.
Now?
In Australia now. Yeah. And that's because of the housing element would be much more significant because of the way that housing is, you know, overextended. And food as well would actually be more significant.
What was the rental component back then? Do you happen to know? Do you know like how rents were weighted back in the, you know, the 70s and the 80s in Australia? Because, you know, these days they're, you know, a Mars bar and a packet of chips in terms of the weighting. You know, I mean, they're weighted pretty much the same as booze, or not far off.
Well, it depends when you look, because it did vary, but I think it was up towards a third at one stage.
Jeez. Okay, so that's a big difference compared with about 7% that it is today.
Correct, exactly. And that was because even then, you know, housing was a significant element. And, you know, if you think about it, back then, the typical mortgage was about 2.5 to 3 times the annual income.
Mm.
Just worth thinking about. Excuse that. Me. And yet, they've got this significant extra contribution relating to the housing element. The other factor is that people were spending a greater proportion of their total income pool on food and medical and those sorts of things. So, you know, we didn't have so much discretionary spending back then. We didn't buy so many flat screen TVs because TV penetration was a lot lower. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why it was different then. But interesting, the transportation costs, particularly vehicle costs and fuel costs, were also higher as well back then. So a bigger proportion, right? So if you sort of mess around with those distributions, which you've got to do, and then actually proxy them across, you get a big number. It's obviously a bit limited in terms of the ability to be able to form any real opinion. But my theory is that there have been a whole bunch of arguments made by a whole bunch of people as to why it is that the real inflation number should be lower than we've actually got. Now, if you actually believe that the older way of calculating inflation is actually more sensible, then it says that the RBA took the interest rate way, way too low to try and actually get to an artificially low 2% target, which begs an interesting question, doesn't it? Where would we have been if we'd used the old mechanism rather than the new one?
That is an interesting question. And I think the thing is there's so many fascinating counterfactuals when you look at that. You know, like what would wages growth have looked like over the last, say, 15 years, if we didn't have that large ramp up in immigration, if we didn't have the number of temporary visa holders, rise well above, 2 million, which is more than 8% of the population, these huge distortions that ended up entering the marketplace and entering the economy, you look at things without that, we would have had a recession for a start if in per capita terms, if you take out the migration aspect. Yep. So what happens there? There's all these fascinating different counterfactuals, and I feel like we're sort of living in another one of those at the moment, because we are seeing this big ramp up in immigration, ramp up in temporary visa holders, and are we going to see wage growth pressures start to die off from these sort of green shoots, these very sort of moderate green shoots that we've already seen so far?
Well, it's clear to me that if you increase migration and businesses, of course, want lower paid people coming into the country, it's part of what that's part of what they've been complaining about, right? It wouldn't surprise me, because we lost about 500,000 temporary workers through COVID, right? That's one of the reasons why the unemployment rate is so low at the moment, because basically the addressable market was dropped by that. So if you bring another 500,000 back in, that's going to have a downward pressure on wages, not an upward pressure, isn't it?
I think that's really the sort of dirty secret of the sort of economic success of Australia during the pandemic. If you take migration out of the equation, if you sort of had have continued to let the same level of migration throughout the pandemic, Australia's unemployment rate at the moment would be about 5.5-5.6%. So we would not be looking at the same sort of very nearly record low unemployment rate that we have today. And I think that's really just, that is not a strong economy. It is just a distorted economy in relative terms. I mean, okay, you could say that it's strong if we just were going to put that setting on migration forever. And if that's what they decided, then yeah, sure, you could make that argument, but that's not what's going to happen. We're ramping up, temporary visa holder levels by my estimates, based on all the different breakdowns of the different visa classes, the ones that would require housing, you're looking at about another 343,000 before we reach pre-COVID levels for all of those. And then you've got another 195,000 permanent migrants from ALBO's ramping up of that. So that's a lot of houses for people to find, and that's a lot of distortion for the labour market to absorb over a relatively short period of time.
Well, and just remember this, of course, that GDP is about activity, right? So the more activity you have, the more people you got in the country, the more people you have travelling around, doing things, buying things, selling things, right? That's all adding to GDP, but you mentioned it earlier on. The GDP per capita is actually the most effective measure of actually understanding what that net contribution is. And at the moment, we're still there's been a lot of quarters where, in fact, GDP per capita has gone backwards.
Yep. No, exactly. It's a flawed metric, but we keep using it because it's easy to buff on out with immigration or even just little things, you know, like defense acquisitions. It's okay, well, let's move this destroyer's acquisition or this particular piece of machinery's acquisition to this quarter, into that quarter, and you can massage it quite nicely.
Yeah, it's called trickery with numbers, isn't it? And that's exactly right. So, you know, we're in the situation, therefore, where the baseline for inflation is questionable, right? Where effectively the targeting of inflation is at best uncertain, right? And where actually some of the fundamental principles that actually drive it are not clear either. So apart from that, everything's fine.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess, really. And I think, you know, that's why we really are in uncharted waters. You know, we've got all this debt, we've got all this central bank intervention already baked in, and we've got inflation, you know, rising to these, you know, previously unheard of levels. And I think it's just worth noting that we, you know, as that graph earlier showed, in year-on-year terms, the contribution from, at least in the US, of goods inflation is disappearing. You know, it's shifting over to services, it's shifting over to food and all these other different things. And I think that's really a concerning picture because, you know, that, as you said earlier, that inflation is the stickier type of inflation. And realistically, goods inflation for the longest time hasn't really been a thing. If you look at goods inflation there, during pre-COVID in 2017 and even during the pandemic, you actually saw goods deflation. And that was relatively normal. Goods being either neutral or slightly deflationary was the norm for not only for years, but for multiple decades. So even if goods inflation comes back to life, and I'm not saying, you know, it needs to roar back like it did recently, you know, with sort of, you know, 3-4% goods inflation, even if it comes back at 1%, if you add even 1% goods inflation onto these levels of just baseline services inflation, which is just caused by rising costs at the most basic level, you're already above the Fed's target and it's curtains. So I think that's something that's really, really worth keeping in mind going forward, because that one little change is all that it takes to completely hit the current interest rate paradigm for six. And it's a similar story for Australia.
Yeah, and I'll make the point here, Tarek, that one of the reasons why goods inflation was so low is we got more and more of our stuff from China, and the costs of producing that dropped. So if you look at a lot of the stuff that we were buying over the last 10 or 15 years, you know, on a comparative basis, it got cheaper, right? And that's simply because the production costs were a lot lower and all that. A lot of it was, of course, high tech as well. But that's all changed now.
Yeah, exactly right. And not only that, but we're not only are we seeing the sort of end of that particular sort of tail, we'll call it tailwind, shall we, for goods deflation. You're now seeing the beginnings of deglobalization. You're seeing reshoring. And it's also the fact that, that the Chinese populace is aging. So they've got rising labor costs as well. So, you know, that sort of conflagration of positive aspects that drove goods disinflation and even outright goods deflation over the last few decades are slowly going away. Now, whether they could come back for a time, particularly as the Chinese government subsidizes their businesses and foreign producers, maybe it's possible. I'm not going to completely rule it out. I think it would be silly to rule anything out at this point, considering how crazy things are. But, you know, on a more longer-term time horizon, particularly given the geopolitical uncertainty surrounding commodities, energy, etc., you know, it's a challenging picture of it, you know, for inflation going forward.
Yeah, it is, and it is interesting as well. If you look at spending expectations in Australia, so there was a couple of surveys. Westpac came out with theirs, and Roy Morgan and ANZ did theirs previously, and the time to buy big items down, time to think about Christmas spending. Well, you know, the Westpac survey includes an extra question, and there were a lot of people saying this year is going to be tight, very tight, right? So you'd expect people perhaps to be spending less on the goods element over the next few months, and that's partly because of inflation and, you know, lack of income and those sorts of things. So actually, maybe the mix of spending will change. And, you know, going back to the US, the goods inflation and the goods expenditure and the services inflation and the services expenditure, right, not only look at the relative growth, but also the mix between the two, services is actually, you know, very significant now. And I suspect we're going to see the same here.
No, I concur. I think that we'll see a similar changeover as the supply chain issues sort of, you know, feed through, and you know, we see the same rise in inventories that we've seen in the US and we've seen it elsewhere. There's been a whole lot of talk about the recent distortions in the CPI, which was put out overnight. So I made this little handy chart that basically shows this is what would happen to core inflation if the only input that would change it over the next 12 months was falling used car prices reverting to their mean, their inflation adjusted mean. And basically you'd end up with core inflation a little under 5%. So I think that there's a solid argument that core inflation will come down and will come down significantly, but I don't think it's getting back to 2% in 2023. I think that's very, very hopeful and very heroic, shall we say.
But that's relevant. That's really relevant, right? Because what you're saying is, if it goes back to towards the norms, the new norm is in much stronger inflation, much higher levels of inflation than we've been used to. Remember, a couple of years ago, the central banks saying we don't understand why inflation is so low. Well, you've got a different problem now. Maybe you've got a new problem, which is inflation is going to stay high. It's going to be well above your target. Now, I'm waiting for the first central bank to say, well, maybe we should redefine the target.
I've heard a lot of people talk about that, and I think that you might see some central banks try it, but I don't think the Fed will. I don't think that they're going to be willing to risk upsetting the bond market and having all their good work blow up in their faces, because, well, that would just be... I think the thing is that it's just for them at this point, it's an unnecessary risk. You know, people are still out there buying treasuries. I mean, you know, you saw this huge move in treasury buying, particularly at the long end,
yep.
You know, with this CPI report. I think there's still plenty of demand out there. It's just that at the moment, nobody wants to catch a falling knife.
No, that's true. And why would the Fed change its inflation target? I mean, it's still got control of what it thinks is the critical issues. You know, liquidity is still the problem in the bonds market, by the way, even now. But less so than previously, and I guess the interesting question that I've got with all of this is that you've got different central banks around the world, all tackling inflation in the same way, all having the same sorts of targeting. To what extent are they actually really operating independently, or are they actually really just following each other, and maybe all just following the Fed anyway? So maybe the true question is, to what extent will we do anything other than what the Fed actually signals we should do? And I have to say that those who argue that we have an objective and independent central bank who, you know, knows its own mind, I don't see the evidence for that.
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting just the difference between what the RBA says and what the RBA does.
Yeah.
You know, like you read some of their statements and stuff, you know, they talk about, you know, I mean, even like something like Bullock, like you were saying that I was reading some of the transcripts, you know, saying basically how inflation is the greater evil, inflation has to be contained and defeated, yada, yada, blah, blah. But if you look at their actions, you know, they're like, oh, you know, we need to stop inflation before it becomes entrenched, and that's why we're doing this 0.25% rate cut. Even though the Fed is, you know, rollicking ahead of us, the RBNZ is as well. And, you know, their excuse is, but wages aren't growing that much. It's just, I just feel like saying to them, it's like, but that is a disaster. This is doing, inflation is doing more relative damage to our economy than it's doing it to theirs.
Yeah.
So this is worse.
Yes.
But that doesn't seem to compute for them.
Well, you know, why? Because of they've got this worry in the back of their minds. Oh, they've got this big household debt problem. We've got all these mortgages. You know, we're going to kill people if we're not careful. I'm sure that's there in the back of their minds.
Well, they should have thought of that beforehand. You know, if you're going to need to go to the hospital, you don't plant barrels of nitroglycerin in the bloody car park. You know, it's just silly. I don't understand it. You know, like. And the thing is that even if you go by their forecasts of containing inflation and you know, heroic forecasts of wage growth, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I hope that wage growth does pick up and that people aren't going to be so utterly crushed by inflation as the RBA suggests, but even looking at their heroic forecast, things are going to get worse before they get better.
Mm. Well, I think that's right. And it is interesting if you look at it, I did a tweet the other day. One of the four banks have actually changed the shading on rental income for the investment sector. You know, they've basically increased borrowing capacity by 8% by doing it, right? And this is just one of a number of things that I'm seeing. We may have touched on this last time with, you know, 40-year mortgages and with getting people to sort of go interest only on the prospect that they can pay off a mortgage with their superannuation when they get to the ripe old age, right? I mean, there are so many things that are actually happening below the waterline to try and put fingers in the dike to stop the pressure, right? You got to say that, you know, the Reserve Bank must be aware of some of these things and some of, you know, but, well, you know, I'm not sure what their real strategy is because, as you say, they should be holding the line. If they believe inflation is the real scourge that they say it is, then they've got no excuse but to actually continue until inflation is dead.
Yeah, but they won't. I'm just waiting. You know, if the Fed does end up raising rates by 0.75% in December, now a lot of people are saying it's not going to happen because of this CPI report. I would say, well, there's a PCE report and another CPI report before the next Fed meeting, so I wouldn't hold my breath on that just yet. And I would also not rule it out, just Powell doing it, just to shock the crap out of the market. Because he keeps, you know, the market keeps rallying. He keeps going, stop rallying.
Yes.
You know, Kashgari came out and said, this downturn in stocks is great. This is what we want to see. And then the market goes, oh, so stocks go higher? And the Fed just goes, oh, we want a tightening of financial conditions. What part do you not understand? You know, and I think that that's a real risk there. I think there's a real risk that the Fed could just turn around and just go, 0.75. Yeah. Listen, you know, I think Powell's getting to the point where he's kind of had enough. He's like, Paul Volcker didn't have to put up with this crap, you know.
Yeah, they took him seriously. Why aren't you taking me seriously?
Exactly. 15 years of the Fed put. And just while we're on the RBA and pressure, this is the last one. So before we can get to the actual questions, people were asking about the relative difference between US and Aussie inflation. Now I just put this chart together, which is the last 20 odd years, and currently US inflation is only just 0.4% above Aussie inflation. Now if current trends continue and if the Q4 CPI does produce the number that everyone is expecting it to, Aussie inflation will overtake US inflation. And because of the used car factor I mentioned earlier, US inflation is going to take a rather significant dive on that factor alone. Yet Aussie inflation doesn't have that factor. So it's either going to keep rising and it's not going to have those same headwinds pushing it down that US inflation has.
No, this is a really important chart because it shows you that whilst the RBA argues, well, wages isn't growing as fast here in Australia as in the US, which is sort of true. The fact is that the inflation challenge is pretty much the same now. We might have delayed it slightly, but we're going to overtake if we're not careful.
Well, we will. I mean, I don't think, you know, there's, unless we see another energy shock, you know, I don't really see how we avoid that if the forecasts are correct. And it's just a bit ridiculous to me because I think that, you know, they can say, oh, but wages. It's like you are watching real purchasing power, years worth of growth and real purchasing power being destroyed. What's driving it is irrelevant. You know, like maybe you guys should look at home equity withdrawals, perhaps. You know, you're all about, oh, but what, you know, people, they got Bullock talking about, well, the impact, is the budget contractionary or expansionary in terms of its impact on inflation? Guess what? The budget deficit is a fraction of the size of annual home equity withdrawals. If more people go out and withdraw equity from their home, it doesn't matter about the budget deficit being that size because home equity withdrawals are a much, much larger factor.
Yep.
But are they going to talk about that?
No, they don't want to talk about that. I was talking to actually somebody quite senior in one of the big four banks the other day about this very point, and he said, we're surprised how strong the demand for equity withdrawals are at the moment. We're expecting it to go down, but in fact, it's gone up.
Yeah, well, they should have just looked at you, should have just spoken to you, mate. You have the data right there, showing it, showing it plain as day. And not only that, but I had an article on it over the weekend. They could have just got it right there, from you, mate.
I know. Well, it's interesting because I said, well, funny enough, I've been tracking that for a few years. Oh, okay, interesting. Well, we should have listened to you earlier because, they've basically done all to do now. So basically the question, no, it's a serious question, right? If they start now being a bit more picky about the echo draw that they're allowed, right, customers will just go somewhere else because they can get, if they switch, they can actually get the equity of draw. So nobody's going to blink.
That's just a perfect storm, isn't it?
It is.
It is an absolute perfect storm because the thing is that if home equity withdrawals continue, and not only that, but I mean, I've gone through like the last 10, 12 years worth of APRA data for savings. There's no sign of people sowing their savings like there was in the US. These sort of signs of financial stress haven't, those particular signs in aggregate, I should make it very clear.
Yep.
Those particular signs are yet to appear. We haven't reached peak credit carrying capacity in terms of credit cards and personal loans. We are nowhere near the GFC peaks in that regard. We could still go a hell of a lot higher. Yep. There's still so much more scope for Australians to continue to spend if they choose to.
Yep.
And if they choose to, the RBA is stuffed because it doesn't matter about wages because all these factors are so much larger than a piddly, 1% extra increase in household consumption driven by wages.
Absolutely. And again, it goes back to the distributional question, right? As we argued previously, we know there's a bunch of people who are really doing it tough at the moment, but there's another big bunch who've still got these buffers and still got this equity and still, well, they're going to go, carry on regardless. So that's the problem, right? Because effectively, if you calibrate the economy based on the people who are struggling, then you would want to take one strategy. But if you actually do it from those with capacity to still spend and spend big, you need a different economy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, realistically, if you're going to try and target spending, you're going to need to use fiscal policy and taxes. I mean, that's not going to happen. So really, I mean, it almost doesn't really bear worth mentioning, but that's the issue. And the problem is that if the RBA just sit back and does jack while people keep borrowing, they keep spending their savings, they keep using home equity withdrawals in order to maintain their spending, inflation can still keep going. And people say, oh, but what if the economy slows down? It doesn't matter. Look at the US economy.
Yep.
The US economy had a technical recession. What happened? Core inflation went higher. Exactly. It needs to get hit by a truck to really put downward pressure on it in this sort of environment. Yep. So, a sort of technical, easy, soft landing recession, I don't think it's going to be enough. Not unless it goes on for a protracted period.
I agree. Now, there was one question which we haven't quite directly addressed, but this chart gets to it quite nicely, right? And the question was, to what extent is the way that we measure inflation here in Australia consistent with the way that the US measure inflation in the US? In other words, are these comparable numbers?
No, not by a long shot. In the US, the shelter component, which encompasses owner's equivalent rent, which is basically people estimating how much their home could be rented for in the current market, and rent itself is almost a third. So you have a market component for housing that is almost a third of US inflation. Yep. In Australia, the market component for housing is only about 7%.
Yep.
So it's less than one quarter of the size of what it is in the US. So even just
on that, remember I said earlier, 20 to 30 years ago, it was the same one third.
Exactly. So they're not comparable in that regard. If you were to somehow magically transpose, particularly given the rental increases in the pipeline, if you were to transpose US inflationary metrics onto Australia, that particular component, considering the rental increases in the pipeline, would go to the moon. You could easily be looking at 10% plus inflation.
Yeah. And that's the biggie, but there's a few others, right, in terms of the way that things are actually measured and calculated and the different distribution of food versus other components as well, right? There are some. And by the way, of course, both the US and the Australian one are sort of bottom up anyway, aren't they? Because they're basically in different regions and they compound the regions up to a national picture.
Yeah, there's that, and then another big one that we talked about earlier was used cars. Used cars aren't in the Australian CPI.
No,
There's a very, very, very limited number that which are sold off by government into the private sector, but that's such a small number that it basically barely, it doesn't move the needle. So the weightings are completely different. The how it's calculated in terms of those big, you know, key things like shelter, etc., are completely different. It's, you know, I mean, they're both called consumer price indexes, but they, in a lot of ways, they really couldn't be more different.
No, and it's just worth reflecting, of course, that the you know, the indices are then used to drive a whole bunch of different strategies and policies and, you know, pricings of different things. Funnily enough, quite often people will argue that the CPI has been artificially repressed because it means you don't have to make such big adjustments then to things like Social Security and those sorts of things, right?
Well, there's also the fact that if the GDP deflator, aka the level of underlying inflation, is lower, it also flatters growth figures too. You know, it can make it, you know, a little bit lower inflation, you know, even if it's like, you know, 0.5, 0.8, can really save a government money. Yeah. And it can make things look a lot better.
Absolutely.
Hypothetically speaking.
Hypothetically. Of course, you'd never do that, would you? Of course you would.
No. We're not something, you know, I'm not running a third world dictatorship here.
No, but, you know, the point about accounting is you can make accounting work for you the way you want to make it work, right? And I have to say that I think there are a number of people in relatively senior positions across government who have a very particular way of presenting information to be able to actually tell the particular story that they want to tell, whether it's actually the full story or whether it's not, right? And quite often it's the likes of you and I who have to go around and say, hang on a moment, what about this? What about that? What about this, right?
Yes, I like our discussion last fortnight about the issues with the unemployment report, about how it was all sampling rather than anything else.
Exactly right.
Well, what's the next question from our intrepid viewers?
Okay. Well, so the other question that came up, and this was actually, again, on the inflation front, right? If you run this sort of number forward, right, based on what we know, where do we think inflation is going to be in a couple of years' time?
Well, that's a good question. For Australia or for the US? Australia?
Australia was where the question came from.
Okay, all right. I think that we're really... So if it depends on sort of when we're talking. If we're talking so like 2024, 2025?
Yeah, so the context was the statement on monetary policy, right? Basically said it's going to be above next year. It'll sort of drift down towards 3-ish or a bit below in 2024. So is that anything like reasonable?
I think that inflation is going to be harder to kill than that, to be completely honest with you, mostly because our inflation is a lot more lagged than the US. I mean, it's not a lot more lagged. It's just that we are approaching it from a lagging position. Like, we haven't even seen a fraction of the rent increases in the CPI run through yet. We haven't seen the increases, the big increases in energy prices run in yet. They're all still yet to come. So, you know, inflation is going to be high into the end of, you know, 2023 and beyond based on that, on those two factors alone. I think that, you know, you're going to need to see deflation and other factors or a crisis or something like that to really put downward pressure on that. And I think that's really going to be one of the key questions in terms of where inflation is in a couple of years, because it's going to depend on where exactly this crisis or this recession ends up occurring. Because I think that it's well and truly possible that in headline terms, we could get inflation back under 3% if things get hit hard enough. Core inflation would be higher, but that would be driven by a collapse in energy prices as it was in 2008. But I don't think that Albo or Dutton or Lowe are going to be able to keep the hammer down on inflation for long enough. I think that when they feel the time is right, they're going to throw stimulus at the economy because they're not going to want to look bad. And the public now expects so much more from the government and so much more from the RBA than they did 40, 50 years ago when this last inflationary episode came out of nowhere, that I think that inflation, you know, that we could easily see sort of 3, 4, 5% inflation, you know, going forward. And just this yo-yo effect of just up and down, up and down, up and down as governments try to and central banks try to temper, you know, these two different forces, you know, a bit like the, you know, the sort of burnout economics thesis, one foot on the accelerator, one foot on the brake, and then just trying to balance the two constantly.
I love the smell of burning clutch in the morning. Yeah, no, that's very good. And there was another question which is sort of follows on from that, along the lines of, well, the UK is now talking about essentially tightening the economy, putting taxes up, cutting public spending. You know, they're going to recession probably. And so the question was, what do we think about Australia? Do we think that they are really going to tighten, lift taxes rather than reduce taxes? Of course, we've got those phase three tax cuts over the horizon there. Spending more, spending less. And the linkage between government spending and spending more and inflation, right? Because effectively, again, going back to the Senate discussion yesterday, the conversation went along the lines of, well, if you spend more, it's going to put more inflation pressure in the system, and that's actually going to be bad because it's going to create more inflation.
Yeah.
So are we looking at tightening? Are we looking at tax hikes and those sorts of things? Are we looking effectively at less government spending?
I think that we're looking at them targeting low-hanging fruit. You know, say, for example, like superannuation tax concessions for the enormously wealthy, for people who have super balances over $5 million. I think that, those sorts of things, some of the other sort of, corporate tax breaks and all that sort of thing, you might see some action there. But I think it's mostly going to be tinkering around the edges. I don't think that we're going to see a Rishi Sunak, David Cameron-esque austerity push here in Australia. I don't think that the debt situation just isn't bad enough yet. Australia's debt relative to our global peers is, less than half, really. We could keep doing dumb crap like this for years and years to come before it would really become a huge major problem, I think. But, I think that there will be more of a political imperative for Labor to show some level of budget improvement. And I think that, it's going to be seen through that lens rather than through sort of tempering inflationary pressures or pleasing the bond market as it is in the UK.
Right. And then following that, which was the other part of the question, and is this an economic or is it a political question, actually?
It's both. It's always both. Mm. For Rishi Sunak and in the UK, it's about, restoring confidence. It's about, giving them that air of, giving his government that air of control. And for here in Australia, having a balanced budget, or a push, more accurately, a push towards a balanced budget in the post-GFC era, is a political imperative, particularly for a Labor government. Because, you've got Labor's debt, Labor's debt, Labor's debt, Labor's debt, as we heard from Tony Abbott, for the best part of, what was it, almost six years.
It felt longer.
for quite a long time. And, it will continue to be a political imperative here in Australia, and I think they're going to keep hammering away, regardless of who's in government, even if Dutton or whoever ends up leading the Liberal Party to the next election gets in government, Labor will hammer them on debt and they will hammer them on spending. So, yeah, I think it's both an economic and a political question.
Yeah. And, of course, you can't really untangle the two because the nexus, of course, is, you got to look at what the opinion polls say, but you also got to look at what the budget says, right? And the two things come together and makes a very interesting question about, well, so who's calling the shots, right? So, is it the Prime Minister? Is it the Treasurer? Or, where does the RBA fit into all of those wonderful questions?
Yeah, indeed. Well, it's a complex web. You've got Treasury saying this is what's possible, this is what's not possible. I think in some ways Treasury's role is underappreciated. It's easy to just look at politicians and go, oh, well, they said they could do this. But really, when it comes to time to actioning a policy, to actually putting it in place, it's going to be the Treasury modelling and what the Treasury modelling says it can and can't do at a certain price that ends up being the deciding factor. Because, say, for example, like the NDIS, when that was introduced by the former Labor government, if that was costed at what it costs today by Treasury, I don't think it would have gotten across the line. I think it would have been a very different story. All the policy would have been trimmed down significantly. So, Treasury plays an important role in guiding what policies end up happening and what circumstances those policies end up occurring under.
Yeah, good point. Well, Tarek, we've managed to get well over the hour and we've ticked off most of the questions. So thank you for all those who threw the questions into Twitter. We might do another Q&A one again because it's quite a good way to sort of explore things which the viewers want to explore. But thanks for putting your charts together, even if it was a bit of a shorter chart session. I think it was very, very relevant and completely aligned with what the viewers wanted to see. So well done.
Thanks, mate. And thanks to the viewers for sending in the questions. We really appreciate it. And at the end of the day, that's what we're here for, you know, for you guys to watch and to, you know, hopefully, you know, get something out of it.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully we'll do another one in a couple of weeks. And by then, of course, who knows where we'll be?
Yeah, who knows what the questions will be then. It could be, could be saying something really interesting. Things are already interesting, but more interesting, shall we say.
As we said before, it's always an interesting question when you live in interesting times, and they're getting more interesting. Thanks,
indeed, Terry. My friend.
No, see you next time. Mate. Take care. Bye-bye.
See you later, mate.